I think many women comedians who have spoken to, and men too, have said that, you know, she paved the way for them, even if that pissed her off. She was willing to really reflect the world as she saw it all through her life. She had the most inappropriate 9/11 joke. And I actually met a woman whose husband was killed in 9/11 and who was a fan of Jones. And I said, you know, she had this really, really funny, but really awful joke. And she said, oh, and she retold the joke to me. I said, yes. I said, were you offended? She said, I wasn't offended because it came from Joan Rivers. And I know that it wasn't intended to be harmful or hurtful. She was just finding the humor in the pain. And because I know that Joan's own life, you know, had so much pain, it was okay.
A woman in the 1950s was expected to stay at home, maintain a 28-inch waist, have two children, raise them to be well-behaved, clean the home, cook hearty meals, and keep her husband happy. If they were lucky, they had a hobby like knitting, painting, or playing the piano. Their full-time job was their family and maintaining the perfect perception of their family. Not Joan. She put on her little black dress, her string of pearls, and armed with her sharpshooting wit, she conquered the stages of nightclubs and told people the truth as she saw it, whether they liked it or not. For documentary filmmaker and family friend Ricky Stern, it was a no-brainer to make this conquistador of comedy the subject of her next film.
Joan Rivers was a comedian who made a career of it from a time when women weren't in comedy and constantly pushed the boundaries and constantly reinvented herself to maintain her relevancy. And she was someone who spoke her mind and spoke from the heart.
Joan's life was a tidal wave of emotion. This petite Jewish lady from Flatbush weathered career highs and lows, sexism, heartbreak, and grief, all while making others laugh. Sometimes with her, most times at her. Can we talk about this blonde bombshell who went from housewife to household name? Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupiak. Joan Alexandra Malinsky was born on June 8, 1933, in Brooklyn, New York. She was the daughter of Russian immigrants. Her father was a doctor with a cracking sense of humor. He used to do impressions of his patients for Joan and her sister. She went to Barnard College and studied theater. She performed in a number of plays and graduated with a degree in English. After graduation, she gave up on acting and got a job in publicity at Lord & Taylor. Joan was a catch. She was educated from a good home and had a good job, but her mother was ruthless and wanted to marry her off to someone as soon as possible. Women didn't have an identity back then. They were defined by their husbands, and Joan's mother was afraid she was exceeding her sell-by date. Joan described this in her stand-up by impersonating her mother, giving her dating advice. When I was 21, my mother said, "Only a doctor for you." When I was 22, she said, "All right, a lawyer, a CPA. 24, she said, "We'll grab a dentist." 26, she said, "Anything. If he could make it to the door, he was fine." She became a buyer for a department store chain called Bond and fell in love with the store owner's son. They got married, but the romance was very brief, and after 6 months, they annulled. At night, Joan was storming Greenwich Village with her raspy voice and self-deprecating sense of humor. The comedy world was male-dominated, and no one saw Joan coming. Nothing and no one was safe. She talked about her family, her upbringing, female stereotypes, womenizing men, celebrities, and so much more. Her big break came in 1965 when she performed on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. She became an instant hit.
She was also such a groundbreaker for comedy, not just for women, but in comedy in general. And she weathered the changes in comedy. You know, she was first the innocent housewife or single lady, and then she was the housewife, and then she was the mother, and then she was the bawdy, brash mouth.
The world was doubled over in laughter, including her future husband. Edgar Rosenberg had just started a film production company. One night, while plagued with a script that desperately needed rewriting, he watched a demure blonde win over a nation in a 5-minute set on late night TV. He contacted her right away and asked if she'd be interested in helping with rewrites. They flew to Jamaica to work on the screenplay, and 4 days later, they were married. Edgar was well-educated, was in the business, and had a very dry sense of humor. Joan was smitten. Her television career took off. She landed a syndicated daytime talk show called That Show with Joan Rivers and continued to appear frequently on The Tonight Show and The Ed Sullivan Show. Joan Rivers became a household name.
I think in the beginning, she was given a chance, you know, and, oh, she's sweet. Look at she making jokes about being a bad housewife. And, you know, she can be with Johnny Carson and make him laugh. And that was okay. And then when she was successful and, you know, had her own talk show, which came and went, you know, I think it's like, oh, she's a successful woman in comedy. I think there was a sense of maybe competition or we don't have to get behind her. Over time, she had a brashness in her comedy, an abrasiveness in her comedy, you know, a no holds bar. And I think she made it acceptable, or because of that, it was acceptable to dislike her, even if you thought she was funny. She did not give a shit about Hollywood hierarchy. She was going to make a joke about Hollywood royalty no matter what. And I think that that was really damaging to her social life, to her personally, because people didn't like that, you know, like, oh, you're going to make a joke about Elizabeth Taylor, the queen of theater, you know, the queen of cinema. And, you know, there were over time, we've seen, obviously, through the years, comedians who will do that. And sometimes they end up apologizing, whatever. But Joan was really, I think, she was bold and she was out there. And people kind of loved to hate her. And I think there's a lot of jealousy in that business, and a feeling like there's not enough room for the comedians that were there. Now, things have sort of changed, you know, but also as a woman in that world, she was so easily marginalized. And I mean, she was really ahead of her time.
She continued to pursue acting. She performed in several small plays, and once she became a TV star, she turned to film. In 1968, she landed a small part in the film The Swimmer with Burt Lancaster. She co-wrote a TV movie called The Girl Most Likely To, and in 1978, she directed her first film, Rabbit Test, starring Billy Crystal. In 1968, she gave birth to her daughter and best friend, Melissa. She continued to perform throughout her pregnancy. Melissa became the subject of many of Joan's jokes, and as she got older, she became Joan's collaborator and partner. Family friend and event designer Preston Bailey saw the bond between Melissa and Joan firsthand.
I think the two of them really worked the mother-daughter story as far as humor. You know, they really got it down. And Melissa, for some reason, she really got it. You know, obviously her mother spoke a lot about her in a humorous way in most of her comedy, or in a lot of her comedies. But I think it's an understanding that they both had that worked very well.
Johnny Carson was so taken with Joan that he made her the guest host when he was on vacation. When she was in the chair, she attracted a younger audience and swiped up higher ratings. She was so popular that in 1983, Carson made Rivers his permanent guest host. Stand-up remained her foundation. Between TV appearances, she headlined in Vegas, bringing her brash humor to the glitzy, debauched desert. She was nominated for a Grammy for Best Comedy Album, and she wrote 2 best-selling books. The trail she was blazing was unheard of for women at this time. She was the only woman who dared to sit in the chair of a late-night talk show host. Few women were comedians at this time, and none were as blunt or brazen as Joan. Nothing was out of reach of her sharp tongue. It was the impact Joan made on comedy that inspired Ricky Stern to produce, write, and direct the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. When Ricky told Joan she was paving the way for women in comedy, Joan objected.
You know what she didn't want? She didn't want to be paving the way and then being told to go sit down and be done. She was like, fine, you know, I can pave the way, but I still want to continue on the road, you know? And I think for her, she says it in the film, like, basically, thank you very much. Like, no, I don't want to be the icon. I want to be continuing on and work. She just loved to work. You can still have friends and you can have family and all these things that Joan, you know, she had. But for her, more than anything, the work gave her the satisfaction. You know, unfortunately, I think the work, and as she said, wanting to be loved, was very tied up in her self-worth. And that's a dangerous thing, you know. But as her daughter says, that's what stand-up comedians are. They're this raw person saying, love me, you know, laugh at me, laugh with me, it doesn't matter, just laugh.
She felt the pressure from all angles. Women were crediting her for opening the door to comedy. Men were telling her she was a fad and they were still superior. But she didn't listen, and in 1986, she got the validation she deserved. Fox Network offered Joan a $10 million contract and her own late-night talk show called The Late Show starring Joan Rivers. This was huge. Her husband Edgar was her manager at the time, and she brought him on as a producer for the program as well. However, the great achievement led to a tremendous loss. Her friend and mentor, Johnny Carson, wrote her off. Her new show would run at the exact time as his, becoming direct competition, and Joan accepted the offer without discussing it with him first. He took it personally. Joan has said she took the job because of a conflict with NBC. And it had nothing to do with Carson. She would always describe him as a father figure who, quote-unquote, handed me my career. Joan was heartbroken by Carson's reaction to her success, but she handled it the way she handled any setback, by sinking herself into her work and indulging in her favorite pastimes.
Well, she definitely liked to stay up late in bed and do the crossword puzzle. She was an insomniac, so she was always reading books. And late in bed, she liked to really like spend a lot of time, you know, like in her bathroom, in her bedroom. Like that's where she would write her jokes, you know, on the bathroom floor. People always ask, like, what did she eat? And I was like, nothing. I mean, she would eat M&Ms. She was like, they're like, oh, is she like drinking vitamin juice? I was like, no, she would drink a glass of red wine. She wasn't a big drinker, but she'd have a glass of red wine and M&Ms and grilled cheese, you know, normal.
Joan was thrilled with the show, but fires were being sparked backstage. Her ratings slumped, and the head of Fox was not a fan of Joan's husband, Edgar. She was given an ultimatum, her show or her husband. She stood by her husband, but she lost her dream. Edgar was suffering from severe health issues, and shortly after a heart attack, he fell down the hole of depression and couldn't get back out. While on a business trip in Philadelphia, he committed suicide. Joan and Melissa were devastated. Joan lost the love of her life, but she also discovered, after his passing, that her husband had accumulated around $37 million of debt in bad investments. Melissa blamed Joan for the death of her father. Joan was alone, single, broke, and jobless.
She was really angry, and she still was angry that he killed himself, because she felt like things got really tough, and partly they got tough because he was her manager and, you know, she was on the show and he was making things tough and blah, blah, blah. And then he checks out and he kills himself and he leaves her to handle everything and their daughter. And it's, you know, people who are survivors of suicide, there's a lot of anger there. I think that was really, she would talk about it, but she was still really angry about it.
Coming up, we'll find out how a broken woman turned tragedy into career triumph. Ladies, I want to talk to you about our sponsor this week, Third Love. They're on a mission to make sure every woman wears the perfect bra. Forget about fitting rooms and weird strangers with the measuring tape and getting tickled under the armpits. No, all you have to do is head to thirdlove.com and take their fun fit finder test, and then choose from their range of 80 different sizes to get a beautiful, comfortable bra shipped right to your door. Now, I may have mentioned this once or twice, but I've got a 10-month-old at home, and I'm pregnant with Babu number 2, so my boobs have been all over the place for the past 18 months. Finding the right bra, it's been a bit of a challenge, and that's why I love Third Love. These are bras made by real women for real women. They're super comfy and super lightweight. They've got these memory foam cups that mold to your shape, and the straps don't slip. And there are no itchy labels, and I guarantee they've got a size for you. What's more, and I personally love this, you get 60 days to try out your new Third Love bra. You can wash it, go about your life, wash it again, and if you decide it's not for you, Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows that not all breasts are created equally, and there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering all of you listening to A Life Lived 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/life now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/life. This episode of A Life Lived is also brought to you by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. For 170 years, it's been covering a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and much, much more. Now, as you can imagine, I'm a huge fan of the TV show 6 Feet Under, and there's a great piece in the archive at economist.com all about the business models of funeral homes and undertakers in this post-baby boomer world. You should check it out. It's fascinating. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free copy now by texting the word LIVED to 78070. That's LIVED to 78070. Joan didn't have time to be depressed. She had a child and a home to support and a career to rebuild. In 1989, she launched her own daytime talk show. It was a great success, winning her an Emmy Award and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
It's what people don't see about Hollywood, about celebrity. It's important to know that it's all hard work. It's putting your foot in front of the other foot, you know, the next foot every minute of the day. It's not about, you know, yes, you get one thing and you have some success in it. It's so short-lived, you've got to get the next thing and have success in it. And I think seeing the process, you know, stripped away of the glamour, of the red carpet, of all of that, to me was so fascinating and so important, because that's what this is really about. It's just, how do you, and her process is, I take 100 things, I throw them up all on the wall, and maybe one of them will stick. For Joan to be with people, whether she was on Celebrity Apprentice, whether she was doing QVC, whether she was rehearsing for a play, whether she was signing an autograph on the street, that was her oxygen. And then when that doesn't work, you know, I'm going to make clothing and jewelry and sell it online. I'm going to recreate myself and reinvent myself, which I found, you know, so inspiring, because her work ethic is like no one else's. I mean, despite like she likes to have a nice house or whatever, she's the hardest worker I know, to the point where we could never keep up with her. We would shoot with her for 3 days and be like, oh my God, we need a week's vacation from this. It's just too much. We can't now go to LA with you. That's ridiculous. You know, like, what are you going to do? Get on a plane now? How can you do that?
She slowly rebuilt her relationship with her daughter, and they mended fences, both professionally and personally. They used filmmaking as therapy and co-wrote, produced, and starred in the film Tears and Laughter, the Joan and Melissa Rivers story, as a way of talking about Edgar's suicide. Family and work were everything to Joan.
it's hard to grow up. I mean, Joan was a working mom. She was transcontinental in some ways in New York and LA, having to go to gigs. And Melissa's an only child, and it's lonely on both fronts. It's lonely for the mom. It's lonely for the child. Then her dad killed himself, you know, committed suicide. And that's traumatic, to say the least. So I think it was hard, honestly. I think it was a hard, but I know the love. They were bonded in that way that was really intense. They had an intense bond and shared everything. And then Joan's grandson, Melissa's son, was so important to Joan Cooper. And I think so important for Melissa to have Joan be that grandmother that sometimes our mothers who worked when we were young, you know, couldn't be there in that same way that they could be grandparents who are just spoiling the grandchild and loving them. And you could see that potential for love and acceptance displayed through her relationship with Cooper. And I think that was such a healthy, wonderful thing for them. And Melissa would probably say it's just hard. It's just growing up in LA, growing up in that world, there's a lot of sort of expectations or pressure or desire maybe to get it, you know, and replicate it.
Joan returned to theater when she co-wrote and starred in Sally Marr and Her Escorts. She nabbed a Tony nomination for Best Actress. She never gave up on acting and what it meant to her.
I didn't really know until I got into this, like, how important it was for her. I didn't really know the history of her doing some stage work and acting occasionally and things. And so when I learned the origin, the genesis of her sort of career in comedy, which came from her desire to be an actor, I really could see that it was the thing she hadn't conquered. It was the thing that I think she built this persona of Joan Rivers, which was her comedy act, as a way of, you know, potentially shielding the real Joan. And I think she felt in her acting that that was a part of her that was her vulnerability, really. It was out there. And so when you said to her, you're not a good actress, it really struck her as a much more personally than people who were critical of her comedy.
Joan graduated from the talk show world, but continued to be a TV personality. She invented red carpet commentary on the E! Series Live from the Red Carpet with her catchphrase, "Who are you wearing?" Her comments and questions alone made fashion sales at global ateliers like Chanel, Louis Vuitton, and Givenchy skyrocket. And each celebrity took her jabs and wit with a smile. Later, her daughter would join her at the helm. This led to her show Fashion Police and launched her reality TV show, Joan and Melissa, Joan Knows Best? Joan's proudest production was her daughter's wedding in 1998. Joan had just returned from a trip to Russia and was given the reins to the show. Event designer and family friend Preston Bailey remembers applying for the job.
She said, "I want them to walk into this ceremony and I want them to absolutely have the feeling that they're at the opera and the stage just went up to the most incredible, incredible setting." That's how she described it to me. And, you know, in a way, we transformed the room to look like a winter wonderland. And the idea of transforming spaces actually began with Joan. She's the one that gave me that concept. Clearly, my entire business is based on that now, in transforming spaces. But at the time, the wedding happened. Joan was incredibly happy. My favorite part of the wedding, which I'm sure everyone still remember, the music that they played when Joan was walking down the aisle, accompanied by her best friend, Tommy, that died a few years back, was the song, "A Big Spender." So that was even kind of a fun, Joan walking into this extraordinary setting and they're playing "A Big Spender," you know, and that was her idea. I mean, you know, you remember that she was funny. So she thought of any way that she could possibly translate her humor as part of Melissa's wedding.
Joan's career had rebounded. She would wake up at 6:30 a.m. and start looking for work. Between TV shoots, QVC spots, design approvals, and 1 a.m. stand-up performances in nightclubs, She always took time out to talk to everyone. Everybody loved Joan.
One of Joan's most amazing assets was that she walked in, and even my assistant, my secretary, my driver, she would turn to each one of them and not only say hello, but, you know, have some kind of a joke or some kind of a conversation with them. One of the things that made her a celebrity was that capability that she had of connecting with people. Even in other meetings, when she would come back to my office for the presentations for us to show her more of the job, you know, she would walk in with donuts for the crew and mixed fun with, you know, she really loved people, you know, and I'm not talking, I mean, she was very unique in that respect, I thought. Not only paying attention to who she's with, but all of the people around her. And for that, I really loved her.
She is just such a force. And so, you know, you walk down the street with her in New York and she stops and says hello to everyone and everyone stops and says hello to her. And she goes to the corner and buys the police officers on the corner a cup of coffee. And it's just an experience to be with her on the street, let alone, you know, spend time with her. So, you know, she was just so real and so present and so down to earth, which I know sounds like the opposite of what people imagine Joan Rivers to be, but it was all there. Just her dedication is so admirable, you know, her commitment to the work she does. And there was a vulnerability. And I really, for me, it was, I really wanted to see that it wasn't going to be a show, that she wasn't going to be guarded. And there was such vulnerability. I mean, even the way, and I found out later, it's sort of one of her techniques. She has a little stool and she sort of sits below you and she puts you in a chair. And so she has this like little child quality to her.
Joan poured her generosity into people. She paid for the private education of her staff out of her pocket. She donated to endless charities. At the height of the AIDS epidemic in New York, she donated her time and money to the charity In God's Love We Deliver. Every Thanksgiving, she would hand out dinners with her grandson, Cooper, to people who were homebound.
Joan spent actually not just Thanksgiving. I mean, she was very devoted to that nonprofit, especially because, you know, it originated in supporting and providing meals for people suffering from AIDS. So it became something that just now they would give meals to those who are in need. But I think she has always been such a trailblazer in the gay community, which I think, you know, I highly respect that. And she was there in that community in before others.
I think once a month she did a comedy show at this one place in New York City that she did it and donated all the money to God's Love Will Deliver. So I've seen her perform live many times. You know, I think she was the funniest person that I know. In the moment of the plague in New York City of the AIDS, I mean, Joan was at the forefront. And again, she have embraced God's Love Will Deliver, which again started out of this company feeding men and women that had AIDS at the time that they fed them every day. And Joan, even back then, she was a big supporter of them to begin with. So, you know, I think she was very much at the forefront in supporting that community, which of course, you know, most of our community really loved her very much.
Joan would always say she loved the gays. She was a huge advocate for LGBTQ rights. Her romantic side may not have been seen on stage, but her friends knew how much she believed in love. When Joan found out Preston Bailey wanted to marry his partner, Theo Bleckman, she insisted on helping the couple.
We went to a couple of her shows and we said hello after or hung a little bit after the shows. And it was, you know, she asked me how I was and included me in all of that. So it was very fleeting. And then she had been pressing on Preston and I getting married even before it was legal at her house in Connecticut. And we didn't, I mean, she just kept saying, you should come up here and we're going to do a wedding for you here and it's going to be so fun. But it wasn't legal yet, so we didn't see the necessity for it yet.
If it was legal, I would love to marry my husband someday. She said, Preston, don't be silly. Come to my house in Connecticut. You're going to get married there. You're going to be at my property. This is going to be a done deal. We're going to do that. which of course we never picked up on it until years later, of course, when I had the opportunity of us getting married in the entire state building, which of course I reached out to her again, and she of course jumped immediately. I'm going to marry you guys.
That was instant. I mean, we didn't even think that she would be able to do it because of her schedule at this date that we had set, which was the night of February 13th into the 14th, into Valentine's Day. But she was able to do it. She flew back from Los Angeles, I think, that day or something to do this, which was incredible.
You know, one of the things that she was good at is preparation, preparing herself. So obviously she got ordained. And, you know, she came with Melissa the day before for the rehearsal. And, of course, for the actual wedding, she was really wonderful.
She had a Bible that she used as a prop, which we now own. Melissa gave it to us. And it's full of notes and jokes and serious stories and all kinds of things that she would say during the service. And I thought that was incredibly telling, because as a celebrity, she could just show up and do her regular routine, if you will. But she was prepared. She actually prepared a whole thing for this wedding. I was singing "You Make Me Feel So Young" while Joan is coming out. So that was, you know, I was basically singing to Joan Rivers. When do you get to do that? That was incredible. The opening line was, "I'm here to celebrate the matrimony of Leo and Pressman." So she deliberately mispronounced our names, and everybody was like, "Oh my God, she doesn't even know who she's." You know, and then she broke the spell and made clear that it was a joke. But that's how it started. And it was funny, and it was also really heartfelt. It was both of those things put together. It wasn't just a big joke and everything was funny, but she brought those two together really beautifully.
Well, she very much stayed the entire night. She and Melissa, they both did, party with Martha Stewart and all of those good folks.
Joan's energy was boundless and exhausting, but the actress never showed it. She kept a sunny disposition and an unbelievable youthful glow. She unashamedly would have routine plastic surgery and allowed it to be the running joke, both in her shows and made on her behalf.
Yes, if you talk about her plastic surgery, she was a lady. She admired the Queen of England. She loved sort of pomp. She loved tradition. But she had a lot of, you know, like most comedians, she really wanted the love of her audience. She wanted to be accepted. And the plastic surgery was just a piece of that. I mean, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to make this movie and I'm going to get the heart. And it's going to be really fascinating about why she does plastic surgery. And that's going to be the heart of the show. And I'm going to get it by the end. And that's what's going to be. And it was like, in two sentences, she was just like, "I do plastic surgery because it makes me feel better. I feel I look better." And I was like, okay, I guess I have nothing else to ask about that. I mean, it was a very, for her, straightforward thing. I feel like I look better. So why wouldn't I do it?
In 2008, Joan and Melissa Rivers competed on The Celebrity Apprentice while it was hosted by Donald Trump. Melissa was fired rather early on, infuriating both Melissa and Joan. But in true Joan fashion, she refused to let it bring her down, and instead, she retaliated. Musician Theo Bleckman remembers when Preston was called to help.
We actually went to see her win The Apprentice. We had tickets to see her at the Museum of Natural History in New York, where they filmed the final episode of The Apprentice, where Joan Rivers won. And Preston, in that episode, created a bridal store for one challenge that they had. I remember that, and I went to it, and I watched her work and sell bridal gowns.
She's so damn competitive that she really wanted to win, you know? So I think it was pretty cool that she won, because here she was, this aging woman who had been so like pushed out of stuff. And look, she was a kick-ass. Why wouldn't she be the best apprentice you could? I mean, she's a titan of industry, you know? Like, she has so many businesses that have been so wildly successful. You know, you'd be a fool not to have her be your quote-unquote celebrity apprentice. So I think she had fun with it. And I think you know, it was that moment in time where things started to click, this karmic moment where things were clicking for her. And you have lows and you have highs, and just being back on television, people remember you and they think you're funny. It helps putting you back in front of the national audience, and then winning is great. And it all came together. And it was funny because we actually interviewed Donald Trump about Joan, and he didn't make it in the movie. All he said was like, she's great. Joan is great. There was no insight. There was nothing deeper.
Her life was an open book, literally. She let people into every detail of her life and her novels, I Hate Everyone, Starting With Me, and Diary of a Mad Diva. She wrote plays and script concepts and never stopped performing stand-up. Into her 80s, her fellow comedians daunted her, even though she was always credited as a titan in entertainment.
They just seemed to fawn over her and just love her in a way that she could never fathom. She just would be like, no, they don't love me. I was like, I think they do. Like, they're acting like they do. To me, they did just think she was amazing. Now, I don't really know, you know, I think she had such a history of feeling outside. She really felt like an outsider that I think it was really hard for her to accept that maybe she was accepted or part of it. And some of it is that Woody Allen, you know, I don't want to be a member of any club that wants me as a member. That I think was maybe a little bit of her ethos. I think she began to accept that she felt as an outsider, that she was an outsider, and that was her shtick, you know?
In August 2014, Joan had surgery on her vocal cords at a clinic in New York. During the procedure, she stopped breathing and was rushed to Mount Sinai Hospital. While Joan was in a coma, Melissa called out to her friends to come to the hospital for one final goodbye.
I remember receiving a call from Melissa, which of course everyone has found out what happened when she went to this doctor and she, you know, became brain dead. And Melissa is like, person, you really have to help me. I want to create a setting for my mother, for her to be able to say goodbye to all of her friends. And I remember going up to Mount Sinai Hospital and in one room, just filling it with flowers. And Joan, at the time, of course, she was unconscious, but she lay there and all of her friends were able to come, including me, of course, and Theo were able to come and say goodbye to her. I thought that was a wonderful way that Melissa handled that, by the way, that she gave all of Joan's closest friend the opportunity to come and say goodbye to her before she was put to rest.
I went to the hospital where my family was, and her daughter was flown in, and she was in the hospital on life support for maybe 5 days or something. And then the family made the decision to take her off life support.
Joan Rivers died surrounded by friends and family on September 4th, 2014. She was 81 years old. Joan's memorial service was at New York's Temple Emmanuel on September 7th. It was filled with friends, family, and celebrities. A fitting tribute to Joan. Well, it should be. She organized it herself.
It was amazing because Joan had planned her memorial service. She was like, when I die, I want a full kilt band, like an Irish. I want them to play The Saints Go Marching On.
The memorial service was flooded with celebrities, of course.
Remember, Mr. Trump was there with his daughter and his wife. It was a really wonderful, wonderful occasion.
Judge Judy and all these celebrities that, you know, you can't believe were there. And it was just a range of showbiz people. It wasn't just comedians or actors. Everyone in New York loved it, or everybody that could be there loved this woman. She was an influential giant.
I remember the entire stage was full with one of her favorite flowers. She was just filling us with orchids. I think there were so many of them there. And of course, it was celebrity driven. You could look it up online. There were these amazing performances and people saying their goodbyes.
We were seated just along with the family in the, you know, third row or something. And that was very, very lovely for us to feel that we were included in this. We weren't just the help or the hired help, but there was a relationship there that was kept and that was honored till the very end. Very lovely.
There were wonderful moments and jokes told about her, and also there was absolutely beautiful songs.
Howard Stern gave an amazing speech about her that was, you know, it was really special. And my mom spoke, and her daughter spoke.
Well, Howard Stern, I think, completely nailed it. I think his opening line, if I'm not wrong, was, "Joan Rivers had a very dry pussy," I think was his opening line. And the entire church just cracked up. And that was so in the spirit of Joan. She was there when he said that. It was so irreverent and so out there. I mean, and then he explained why, and that it all made sense, and it was all beautiful and funny and clever and intelligent. But when you first hear that, you're in the synagogue, and it's just, it was amazing.
One of the things that kept coming up over and over and over is that the persona of this brass comedian, outrageous and whatever, that wasn't her at all. She was the opposite. She was a very caring person. She was a very giving person. You know, she really had that other persona of being very caring and making you feel important. That's what she did. She made everybody around her feel loved and important.
Member of her, one of her agents might have spoken. It was small in terms of the number of people who spoke. It was, you know, she wasn't like too elaborate in that way, but it was huge. And it was of course incredibly bittersweet, but it had the joy. We marched out to the Saints Go Marching On.
And afterwards we went to her house for a gathering of, you know, her best friends and her family, just to sit around and sort of tell stories a little bit. And that was all lovely. I think the real impact of her loss, and that's true for most deaths, comes much later. Because at that moment, you're hopped up and you're meeting people and you're doing things and there's a service and there's an agenda. But then when you stop, that's when you actually feel the sadness.
Joan was a lot of things. She was a wife, a mother, a comedian, a designer, a grafter, a saleswoman, a joke, a trailblazer, and a friend. But she never thought of herself as an icon.
The most disarming, lovable sharpshooter.
She was this groundbreaking comedian who... Hopefully, some of the legacy is that you just have to do what it is that is right as a performer, as in anything. When she was told, you know, don't talk about abortion, she talked about it. When she was told, don't be so raunchy, she did what she wanted. And she was willing to test the boundaries and push the boundaries. And I think that's and willing to be a woman who was not going to apologize for her aspirations and for her ability to take care of herself, to be strong, but to still have vulnerability.
She was real. And I still miss her. I really miss her.
Ricky Stern's new series, Preppy Murders, premieres on AMC November 13th. You can see Preston Bailey's creative configurations and learn a few tips on event design in his books available in hard copy or Kindle. If you want to book him, go to PrestonBailey.com. Be whisked away by Theo Bleckman's music, available on iTunes and on his website, TheoBleckman.com. Next time on A Life Lived.
There's no one in the recording studio, and he's sitting at the board. He's got a little crust from food here. He smoked enough weed and drank enough Hennessy, and he's basically propping himself up on an arm, and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and, you know, it's like not much of it is the ash. And he's just rocking himself, and the line that he's listening to is, "My only fear of death is reincarnation. I used my last breath to save a whole nation, right? And I mean, look, I get chills when I even think about that.
We sat down with filmmaker Gobi Rahimi and talked making music videos and guarding the deathbed of the rap legend, Tupac Shakur. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.